nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So to continue what we were doing last day, the basic point I was trying to get across is that this differential equation, that usually when you start your discussions of quantum mechanics in general, you start from a differential equation, the Schrodinger equation. And for analytical solutions, that's particularly convenient. You can often write down for certain special cases analytical solutions that satisfy that differential equation. On the other hand, for most numerical things, you prefer a matrix version of it. And any differential equation, there's this equivalent matrix version that one can write, which you could view as a sort of difference equation rather than a differential equation. So like here, x is a continuous variable. Here you think of it like you have some discrete variable. And for the moment, we are thinking of it just as a discrete lattice so that x takes on some discrete values. Now, as I discussed last day, then, if you have a uniform medium, and usually, of course, we are not talking about uniform things. We have potentials that vary with x. But if everything were constant with x, then the solutions can be written in the form of plane waves like this. You don't really need to go to a computer, write, I mean, even think about it. It's exponentials like this will always satisfy this differential equation as long as everything's constant. And if you substitute this in here, then you can easily prove to yourself then that in order for this to satisfy either the time-independent version or the time-dependent version, E and K must be related by this relation, which is called the dispersion relation. So for any differential equation like this that's in a homogeneous medium, nothing's changing with x or time, homogeneous time-independent medium, you can write a dispersion relation. And what I was trying to discuss last day is, with a difference equation also, if things don't change as you go along, so that if this HNM, this matrix, it's like every line looks the same, if that's the case, then you can write solutions in the form of, again, exponential IK, let's write it here, write it as phi N equals e to the power ikNa. Just as in the, for a differential equation, you could have written it as e to the power ikx. Here you could write it as e to the power ikNa. And if you substitute that solution in here, you'd get a, again, a relationship between e and k that must be satisfied in order for this to be a solution of that. And it will look something like this in general. Where I'm calling this dn. It's like the location of the nth point. So if you call that dn, then in general, you'll have something like this. So this you can easily substitute it in here and see. And what we did last day was a special case. Special case meaning, you know, HNM in general could have all kinds of structure. But a special case we took was where the diagonal elements were epsilon and the connection to the next nearest neighbor was T. Now, in that case, what happens is when you sum this, only three terms contribute. Because if you stand at any point N, and you're going to sum over all m. So which values can m take on? Well, of course, infinite values. M could be this one, this one, this one, etc. But in this model, only three terms will contribute. When m is equal to n, when m is equal to n minus 1, when m is equal to n plus 1. Because beyond that, h n m is 0. So you get these three terms, which are like epsilon plus t e to the power plus ika. So epsilon comes from when m is equal to n. That's when this phase factor is 0. So that's it, epsilon, this t pi plus ika and t e to the power minus ika. That's it. And when we combine that, we got this epsilon plus 2t cosine ka. So when we compare this relation with this relation, you know, there's two dispersion relations. If you compare, they don't quite look the same. You know, one is cosine, the other is a parabola. And what I explained last day was that for small ka, you could make this look just like that if you chose your parameters epsilon and t appropriately. So that is one way of trying to figure out what's the best difference equation to use so that it will behave a lot like that differential equation. Now, there are other ways. There's the finite difference method, for example. You could have started with this, gone to a discrete lattice and tried to figure out what this equation should be. But what I found most useful in connection with the problems we'll be doing is just to compare dispersion relations, essentially. But to make it work, if you're given something like this, if you have reason to believe that electrons in the region of in the energy range that you're interested in behave like this, you have some effective mass, then, and you want to model it with a discrete lattice, then you should choose epsilon and t such that this and this for small ka match. They won't match over all ranges, of course, only for small ka. So, for example, take this on. If you look at the parabola, of course, it will look something like this. If you look at this, it could, depending on whether t is positive or negative, it could look either like a parabola or like an inverted parabola. So if t is positive, actually, it will look like an inverted parabola. Why is that? Because, you see, if t is positive, when ka is equal to 0, that's when the cosine is a maximum. Cosine is 1. And it goes down as you get away from it. On the other hand, if t is negative, then you could make it look just like this one. And you can match the two, for example. So this would be one way of getting there. Now, you might say, well, that's not a very good approximation up here. It's only down here that it's good. That's true. And as long as electron energy ranges are confined here, the answers you calculate numerically would be much like what you'd have got from the differential equation, as long as we are talking of energies down here. Now, in an actual solid, of course, you might say, what people would argue is that this is probably more correct than that anyway. Just because in the actual solid, it's not as if you really have a parabola going on forever. Your real EK relation that you're trying to imitate for that solid usually would probably fit this one much better than that one anyway. And so this discrete lattice that I put up there, there's two ways of thinking of it. One is that, you know, you have just chosen some discretization, you know, and the spacing could be 10 angstrom, 5 angstrom, 20 angstrom, depending on your problem at hand. Or you could view that discretization is just the natural discrete lattice of any solid anyway. So it's atomic distances, you know, 2.5 angstroms or so, whatever that is. So you could view each of these points as just being atoms, actually, for example. Okay? So this we'll talk a little more about as we go along, that exactly how one obtains these parameters, how to choose these lattices, etc. But at this point, the main thing I wanted to get across is that differential equation and this matrix equation and the correspondence between them. And in either case, as long as you have a uniform medium, and what that means is nothing changes as I go from left to right, as I walk across the lattice. It always looks the same. Because if, for example, u were a function of x, then you can immediately see that there's no way this is a solution. Because if u were a function of x, you could adjust your E and K to work at one point, but it wouldn't work somewhere else. Now, of course, you could write an approximate solution where the K keeps changing with X. That's like the semi-classical view, that when X, U is changing with X, you think of it like for a given energy as if the K keeps changing. That's the semi-classical. But then that's approximate. And if this varies rapidly, then that's not correct either. And the same here, as long as everything changes, nothing changes across the lattice, you have an EK relation. If it's changing across the lattice, well, if you want to model it from this point of view, then you would make this epsilon a function of X. So, for example, what you do is, in this lattice, you change the epsilon as you go along. So, in a solid, if you actually had a potential, you change the epsilon. Of course, you don't have an EK relation anymore. That's fine. But you start with the homogeneous thing and then add a potential to it, etc. So that's how you'd choose this Hamiltonian. Now, what I want to discuss in this notes that I handed out, I guess hopefully you all have a. Okay. Did we run out of? You didn't? Oh, yes, please, go ahead.
The matrix equation you have written has finite number of points. That means these eigenstates are finite. But I have a doubt. I mean, if I change the spacing, then also eigenstates will vary. So in a real solid, is it like that? I mean, number of eigenstates is finite. And say I take 100 atoms.
In a given energy range, right? So if I take a solid here, let us say, of length L, then what you can show is that you will also get the number of eigenstates you will get here will be equal to the number of points in that lattice. That you can expect because it's a matrix equation and the matrix is an n by n matrix. I mean, that H is an n by n matrix, so it should have n eigenvalues. Okay? Now, the way this one works then is that if you make it longer, then you get more points in here in this model. If you calculate it, it would look like this. There would be more points. Now, and so finally, the number of eigenstates you'd get would still be equal to the number of lattice points. And in a real solid also, yeah, that is true. In a real solid. Okay? Now, when you have this parabola, that of course is in vacuum, infinite, and that goes on forever. But in any real solid, I'd say that the range of this, how far you go, that is determined by the spacing between the two lattice points. So usually, you know, this plot would run from minus pi over a to plus pi over a. Because once you go outside of that, what happens is you don't get any new solutions. You know, it just, this solution is really the same as that one. You're not getting anything new after that. So this range is minus pi over a, and the spacing here is 2 pi over l. And so the overall number of eigenvalues is L over A. That's what happens. Now, so what you could ask, say in a real solid also, yes, you'd have discrete number of eigenvalues, and this could be made to, and you could choose your model so it would actually match, right, what it is. In vacuum, the thing is that there is no real discrete lattice in there. So this lattice, as I said, you could think of it in two ways. One is that it's just a numerical approximation to the real thing. But when you're dealing with solids, it is the real thing in a way, because there is a discrete lattice, really.
So the spacing we have to take, it should be more than the lattice spacing.
More than the lattice. Right. And usually my criteria I always use is that in your energy range of interest, it should match the dispersion relation that you're trying to imitate. So if this is the energy range that you're interested in, you have to choose it. So, because if you choose your lattice a little too far, then you might find that this is going, it's not even matching very well up here. It goes, doesn't match it even down here. That's all. Right. So, anyway, so the point was then that there's this differential equation and the difference equation, and they could be made to correspond if the dispersion relations look similar. Okay. So, one use of this you could do is if you are doing a time dependent problem of some kind. So, let's say I've got a lattice, and we want to know that if you had a wave function like this somewhere around here, how would it propagate with time? Let's say. You know, one of the things I had said before is that when you have a wave packet, its center of the wave packet moves according to this group velocity, 1 over h bar dE dk. And this is usually based on the arguments you see in freshman physics, usually about the group velocity. But you could test this out numerically. See if it really works. How does it work? So how do you do it? Well, for this, you'd actually need the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Now, for most of what we'll do in this class, we'll be using the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Steady state, you know, continuous flow of electrons with coming in with some fixed energies, and you just integrate over energy. So we'll really be working with something like this most of the time. But for this problem, let's talk about the time-dependent one, how you'd use this. So it's like, in the beginning, I have a certain wave packet. How does it move with time? Okay. So first thing you try to write down then is, what is psi of 0? You know, this is like a column vector. Psi of 0. At time equal to 0, what does it look like? Okay. So you could say, well, I could write it as e to the power ikx, for example, with a certain k. Now, if I do this, then you see it's very hard to tell whether it's moving one way or the other. Why is that? Because e to the power ikx is just all over the place. You can go to any end of the lattice, it's still there. So you simulate it with time. A little later, you see something that's still all over the place. So you can't quite tell if it's moving at all. Now, the way you can tell if it's moving is you have to create something that's localized in the first place. So you could set up a lattice like this, you know, lots of points, and in the beginning, put in a wave packet that's localized over, say, 10 or 20 of these, some number like that. So you could put in something here, so this is like e to the power ikna psi n at 0, and then something that makes cuts it out, so something that goes as, say, n square. Or I guess if I do this, it will cut out within one or two lattice spacings, so I could make it go over longer lengths by dividing it by some number here. You know, so this n0 could be, say, 20, in which case when n is equal to 20, that's when it might, I guess I shouldn't, when n is equal to 20, that's when it might actually cut out properly, right? So n0 will determine whether I want it to go over 20 spacings or 10 of them or 5 of them, etc. So you could choose something like this. Now you'll notice this kind of a state actually, another way of thinking of it is, it is composed of many different k's. Because if I took this and Fourier transformed it, I'd get all kinds of k's. Okay? So that's another way of thinking that. Because in order to localize it in space, you have to put in a whole bunch of k's in a way. But in real space, I could write it this way. E to the power a pure k multiplied by something that cuts it out. You know, so right around n equals 0, it gets cut out. So that's the wave function at time equals 0. So I could write this out. I'd have this full column vector. Now, question is, how do I know how it behaves with time thereafter? Well, that's where I have this differential equation. It tells me what psi will be at a later time. And in matrix form, you see, it's like d psi dt is equal to h over ih bar psi. And the solution to this you can write as psi of t is equal to e to the power minus I h t over h bar psi of 0. That's it. Because this is a different, this is matrix equation. And as long as h is time independent, which it is, it's just propagating on a fixed lattice, nothing's changing with time, it would look something like. By the way, I might have confused you with one thing, and that is, I've written here t, which is like this element of the matrix that connects the nearest neighbors. And the dimensions of this, of course, just like everything in H, the dimensions are energy. So that T is, say, 100 millivolts, 1 volt, etc. T is always energy. And it has nothing to do with this T, which is time. Right? So either we can put a T0 here to remind ourselves it's something else, something different from that one, or in later on, this confusion won't arise because we won't be talking of time-dependent problems at all anyway. So the only t you'll see is that one. This t won't even arise, right? So this is about the only time-dependent problem we're talking about. Okay? Anyway, so here then the point was that from the initial condition, I can write the wave packet, which tells me where the electron is in the first place. And then if I multiply it with this, and remember this is a matrix because this is exponential of a matrix. If this is n by n, this exponential is again an n by n matrix. Right? And you can multiply the initial condition with that matrix and you'll get the final wave function. That's it. Now, how do you calculate the exponential of a matrix? Okay. If you're using MATLAB, though, basically, you just tell it to calculate something like this, except for one little thing, and that's this. If you tell MATLAB to calculate this, it won't calculate what you really need. Why is that? Because here what it will do is it will take this matrix. So let's say I've got A, B, B, C, you have some matrix like this, H. If you tell it to calculate that, it will put e to the power minus I A T over H bar, e to the power minus I B T over H bar. It will do something like that. In other words, it will just take element by element and do what you asked it to do, which is not what you want. You want the actual exponential of this matrix, which is something different, right? That's this general idea of how you calculate the function of a matrix. And if you want MATLAB to do that, you have to say EXPM, and then it'll do it. Now, the actual function of a matrix, the way it is supposed to be done is something like this, and this will talk more about when we get into spins and things like that. Right now, I'm just mentioning it because, and that is that the way you find any function of a matrix is the following. You first do a basis transformation so as to diagonalize it. So you make it diagonal. because any matrix, you know, here you could always find some unitary transformation, some basis transformation that will make it diagonal. Now, once it's diagonal, then whatever function you want to get of this matrix, you know, it could be exponential, could be cosine, could be whatever function, logarithm, whatever you want. You do that here on the diagonals. Having done that, you then do the inverse transformation to get back to your original basis. Now, of course, MATLAB, if you tell it EXPM, it will do just that for you. Okay? But it's important to know what exactly it is doing anyway. Okay. So that's the basic idea. So here also it is sort of like that. If you tell it to do this, it will take this, go to a basis in which this is diagonal. So you have all these various energy eigenvalues. And then it is as if each one becomes e to the power minus I e1 t over h bar, e to the power I e2 t over h bar, etc. And then you go back to the original basis, etc. So the physical implications of all this, this we'll discuss more later. Right now, I just wanted to give an idea of the mechanics of how you'd do this. Okay. So if you do that, then after some time, you could figure out what the wave packet will look like. And what you'd find is the wave packet is actually moving forwards if this k you chose was positive. And if this k you chose was negative, you'd find it's actually going backwards, for example. And this works fine. I mean, you could continue it for, you know, you can change the time and make it go forwards more and more. What you could do if you wanted the velocity, for example, what you could do is you could plot against time how the average location of the wave packet changes with time. How do you find the average location? Well, the idea is that the psi is this wave function whose square tells you the probability distribution, how the electron is distributed, psi star psi. So if you want the average location of x, you do something like this. Integral dx, psi star, psi times x. So this tells you how it is distributed in x. And if it's normalized, this is all you do. If you haven't bothered to normalize it, then you should remember to divide it. So psi star psi tells you the probability the electron is at some point x. It tells you the probability distribution, how it's distributed. So this is how you'd get the average. So you could find this initially what it was. So initially, of course, it was right in the middle, wherever you put your wave packet. And then with time, it will move either forwards or backwards, and you can plot this out. And you can see how it moves. And that should actually match dE/dk. 1 over h bar dE/dk. So it's a good way to see how this works. Okay. Now, if you go too far in time, though, you run into trouble because the wave packet hits the boundary. And at that point, depending on what you have done at the boundary, what kind of boundary conditions you use, you might get all different kinds of things and could get confusing also. Because if it's a brick wall there, you know, you just stopped it someplace here, then what happens is once it hits the boundary, it starts coming back. And then after that, you see something going forward, something going backwards, and looks like a mess. You don't quite know what happened. Okay? Or what sometimes people do is they put a periodic boundary condition. That is, this end, they kind of connect it back up there. So as if when you get to the point number one, then you connect back to point number n on the other side. Put something in your matrix that connects you back. Then what you'd see is a wave packet that goes like this and kind of comes back that way, etc. Or you could put something you could call an open boundary condition, an absorbing boundary. And this will discuss how you do that, because that's what's most commonly used for transport problems. You actually have an absorbing boundary. The idea being, once the wave packet goes there, it just gets out of your system. It doesn't mess anything up, just decays. Okay? Okay. So that's what you really visualize your contacts as. Electrons come in, go to the contact, and then just go away. That's what ideally should happen at a contact. Sometimes contacts might have strong reflections, in which case it does mess up, you know, it does come back and contribute to to the current and all that later. Okay, so this is just to give you an idea of how you might use this. Now, in general, then, this, what I handed out today, this is like what I'll be talking about rest of the class today and Monday, right? And this is the set of equations that kind of tells you how to calculate the current in a device. And first thing you need is what I've called this H here. That is what describes the dynamics of the channel. How do electrons get from left to right? And that H, how do you write it? Well, we've given you one example here. It could look something like this. Epsilon on the diagonal, something that connects it to the next nearest neighbor. You could have much more complicated things, depending on what kind of device we are talking about. But first, you want to do the simplest thing and see how it works. And the basic equations are the same. Later on, you might find other ways of writing these things, H's and all. But the basic point to note is everything that appears here, I mean this H and this sigmas, these are all matrices. What's the size of the matrix? Well, that depends on the size of your device. How many grid points, essentially. But grid point I'm using in a more general sense, because simplest case of a grid point is just how many points in real space. In general, it could involve basis functions and all that. That number could be bigger. But basically, it's the idea of how many grid points do you need to represent what you are trying to describe. And I'd say that in principle, this is all you need to calculate. In practice, the problem starts when these matrices get big. Because these days, I'd say on your laptop, anything up to 200 by 200 is easy. Then as it gets bigger and bigger, you may need to have all kinds of numerical tricks to handle all that, which we don't really get into in this class. Right? Because what I'm trying to convey is just the basic principles of it, how to do it. And with 200 by 200, you can do a lot of interesting problems anyway. Right? That's what we'll be trying to do. So the basic things you need is H, and then this sigmas. That's what needs some discussion also. What's the sigmas? That's essentially like what you do at the boundaries. That kind of tells you how the electron, this channel, how it connects to your two contacts. That's what the sigmas are about. And once you have H and sigma, that's it. That's all the input. And then after that, these are all just matrix equations that basically tell you how to calculate electron density, current. Okay. So what I'll be trying to do rest of the class today and Monday is just trying to give you a feel for where these equations come from. How do you get it? Because this doesn't look anything like Schrodinger equation. But the thing is, it comes from Schrodinger equation, really, in a way. And what I want to explain is what was involved in getting from Schrodinger equation to here. And yeah, and what I've down here is just something that helps you kind of get a physical feeling for what it is we are talking about. So for example, up here in the matrices, you'll see something called G super N. That's, I think, in equation number 3. Now, that's a matrix, and often you may not know exactly what it means, but the thing is, basically, it is like electron density per unit energy. And so, one way to get a physical feeling for this is, if all those matrices were just simple one-by-one matrices, just one, which means as if you had a device with just one point, just one energy level, for example, just one thing, then those equations would have become what I have down here. And then what's down here, those actually you can understand relatively easily with simple physical arguments. You can see what's happening. Okay? So that's just as a guide that what exactly we're talking about and so on. Okay. So these, I'm never quite sure whether to hand this out after the discussion or before the discussion. Because before the discussion, it all looks kind of mysterious, and I'm not trying. So, yeah, so don't worry too much about this. Let's just, start from Schrodinger equation and try to get there. Now, the basic argument goes something like this, that if you look at the Schrodinger equation, we have, I think I wipe this off. And we are talking about the time-independent Schrodinger equation. So you have something like, right here, E phi is equal to H phi. And then we can think of the H as a matrix. These phi's are the column vectors. Okay, and let me write it actually as, this is fine. So usually the way you go about doing problems is you find the eigenvalues of H. Those are the energy levels. Okay. Now, what we are interested in is current flow, which is like this open problem. What you have is continuously electrons that come in from the contact, go back, and then some part of it transmits on and so on. So what you're really talking about is this open system, whereas what this describes is just a closed system sitting by itself. Okay? So if we wanted to find the eigenvalues, that would be. Now, I could turn this around and write it something like this. So I've put an I, capital I here, nothing to do with current, that's the identity matrix. Right? Because E is a number, so EI then becomes like an N by N matrix, H is N by N matrix, times phi, that's this column vector, equal to 0. So this is really the same thing as that. I've just written it this way. And the usual view is that, well, unless the energy matches one of the eigenvalues of H, phi is 0. You know, think of the simplest case, like if H is a 1 by 1. So then what you have written here is E minus epsilon times phi equals 0. So in that case, if E is equal to epsilon, phi could have a non-zero value. But if E is not equal to epsilon, well, phi is 0. So the only way you have any solutions is if the energy is dead on one of those eigenenergies. But in an open system, you have to kind of change your viewpoint. You think totally differently. It's like electrons can come in from here with any energy E. If it doesn't have to match one of the eigenvalues of the system, it could be off. Now, if it is dead on, then you'll get a big response. If it's not dead on, then you may not get a big response. That's all. So the difference is you have a guitar string. Left to itself, it has certain resonant frequencies. But then when I'm trying to pluck it and trying to get it to vibrate, so I come in and excite it with some tuning fork. The tuning fork doesn't have to match the guitar exactly. It could be a little bit off. It would still vibrate. If it's dead on, then it will vibrate very strongly. That's about it. So the thing is, in all the problems we are doing, it's not like E has to match one of the eigenenergies of your system. E is a continuous variable. It could be anything. It could have any value, and if it happens to match things, then you'll get then the electrons will be able to get through it easily. If it doesn't match, not so easily. That's it. Okay. So the way you go from the Schrodinger equation to this open system is first two things. One is this sigma here, which represents the fact that you are coupling to the two contacts. It's like this guitar string is damped. Damped because anytime you pluck it, the energy can flow away. So anytime you put an electron in there, it can go away into the contacts. That's what that sigma represents. And this H is a Hermitian matrix with real eigenvalues. This one is a complex matrix with, as we'll see, complex eigenvalues. And the fact that the eigenvalues are not real, that kind of gives the damping. That's what allows that's what describes this flow of electrons out into the contacts. That's number one difference. And the second point is, now, of course, if you just put this in, then the answer would be for any real energy, phi is 0. Now you can see, because H plus sigma now has complex eigenvalues. And as long as E is real, the only solutions look like phi equals 0. And that would be the case if, you just had this channel sitting by itself connected to no particular source of electrons. But the thing is, you now have electrons coming in from the contacts. And that is described by some kind of a source term here. So this is the represents the fact that there is something that's plucking the guitar. Could be a tuning fork, could be a finger, whatever it is. That's that part. That's these electrons from the contact. That represents what's coming in from the contact. And so, finally, we start from a Schrodinger equation looking like that, but what I'll describe to you, we'll go through the algebra with an example, how this kind of becomes looking, starts looking like that. The sigma and the S. And the solution to this, you could write as phi equals GS, where G is equal to EI minus H minus sigma inverse. Because you see, this E minus H minus sigma times phi is S. So if I want to write phi in terms of the source, it would be like phi is equal to this inverse times S. And this inverse is what's called the Green's function of the system. That's like what you call the impulse response or the Green's function. So, and that's like your equation number one. G equals E minus H minus sigma inverse. That's kind of the basis of it. Okay, so what we'll do is, let me try, I'm thinking of, we can do one of two things, given the time we have left. One is try to go, yeah, maybe we'll do that. That is, let me explain then how you get from here to here. What happened here, okay? Okay, so going back to this problem then, let us say this is the point. So let's take a relatively simple device with just two points. So there's just two points, one and two. And on this side you have a zero, this side you have a three. So let's say this is the real device, points 1 and 2, and it is connected to two contacts on the two sides. That's the 0 and the 3 going off to both sides. And so if I had to write H, that's easy enough. You know, H would look like just epsilon on the diagonal and P next to it. Because the device has just two points. But the problem is, then, how do I write the sigmas? How do I describe the boundaries? Okay, we'll come to that. So, now, if I didn't know about any boundaries, and we are just trying to write out these equations, it would look something like this. At point one, I'd have E psi 1 is equal to epsilon psi 1 plus T psi 0 plus T psi 2. Now let me write it this reverse. T psi 2 plus T psi 0. And then E psi 2 is equal to epsilon psi 2 plus T psi 1 plus T psi 3. So all I've done is written down our difference equations at those two points, 1 and 2. So, you know, in general, the difference equation looks something like this. Oh, by the way, I guess I was writing phi before and I went to psi. I mean, nothing profound involved, just that I forgot which one I was writing, okay? So, this psi, yeah, same thing as whatever we had before. Okay. As you know, the general equation is E psi n is equal to summation over m, h n m psi m. And so, all I'm doing is writing n equals 1, and then writing out, when I write out this summation, I only have m equals 0, 1, and 2. three terms. Similarly, when I go to n equals 2, I have 1, 2, and 3. So those are the two things I've written. That's it. Nothing much. Now, this much looks like E equals H psi. You know, because H is like epsilon T, T epsilon. So this part of it you could view as if you have E psi 1, psi 2 equals epsilon T, T epsilon psi 1, psi 2. E equals H psi, this much. But then you have these two extra terms that comes from something outside your real device. And what you want to do is get rid of these. Get rid of all this, psi 0 and psi 3, so you can write it in terms of psi 1 and psi 2. And then it'd be done. Okay. So that's what I want to do. And now this is a little easier on this side than on this side. And that is because in this problem, let's assume an electron comes in from here, and then there is a reflected wave, something that goes back. And on this side, you have some transmitted wave, which is like e to the power ikx. And on this side, you assume that what's coming in, let's say, is e to the power ikx. And what goes back out is e to the power minus ikx going the other way with some reflection coefficient r. So the idea is, you say that once you go into the contacts, that's where you have a uniform medium where I know that I can write the solutions in the form of plane waves because it's a nice uniform contact. And so I write it this way. Now, why don't I write e to the power minus ikx there? Well, because physically I'm considering a problem where an electron came in from here, some of it got reflected, some of it got transmitted. And physically, I'm not worrying about what is coming from here. Now, you might say, well, you might have some things coming in from the other contact, but that we'll talk about separately. And there's a subtle issue involved as to how you add those two things. Yeah. Right. So I should put a T here. And the reason I'm hesitating is we have too many T's already in the problem. So I'll put a tau there. Okay. Now, what I'm really trying to do is eliminate these points 3 and 0 in this discussion. Now, the 3 is actually quite easy to eliminate. It goes like this. You say that once you're out here, the wave has that form. So it should be like psi 2 is like, say, tau, from psi 2 to psi 3, it has this form of e to the power ikx. So let us say psi 2 is, some e to the power ik 2a, then psi 3 would be like e to the power ik 3a. So after this, it's just got a phase factor that adds on. So what that means is psi 3 will always be just psi 2 times e to the power ika. So if you accept that, and this is what we'll continue next day properly, then what happens is you see I can take the psi 3 out and put a psi 2 e to the power ika. And see, now I've eliminated the psi 3. But I've now got a new term, this t e to the power ika, that has to be added on to what I had. So anyway, these are the sigmas, really. You see, this is the e equals h psi. And then these extra terms you accumulate, that's what goes into the sigmas. So that it then becomes like e psi equals h plus sigma psi. The sigmas are what you get by doing this stuff. So that's the t e to the power ika. Now, when we do it at this end, that's when you'll find that you not only add something to this one, because you not only get something that is proportional to psi 1, just as here you got something proportional to psi 2, here you'll get something proportional to psi 1, but you'll also get an additional constant term to it. And that is that source term. I mentioned that what happens is, by the time you're done, it looks like E minus H minus sigma psi equals S. So this extra term, the source term, that will come in when we try to eliminate the psi 0. You'll see there's an extra term there. So that's basically what is involved in a way, that what you do is you're connecting it to the contact, assuming wave is coming in, going out, and then when you eliminate those boundary things, that's when you end up with a basic equation looking like this. And the advantage of this one now is that this H, sigma, these are all matrices whose dimension is the same as that of your device. So if your device has 2 points, these are 2 by 2. Even though the contacts themselves have millions of points. I mean, this is a very big thing. But you have kind of gotten rid of all that and put all that information into your sigma. Okay? So let me stop here today. We'll finish this up on Monday. Thank you.